Now, I want to now apologize to the audience, at least those that were in the talk that I gave you a couple of months ago and those at Santa Barbara a few months ago. This is pretty much the same talk. I've just cut out some of the introductory stuff just to fit it in, at least the planned 30 minutes, 35 minutes. But of course, I anticipate that there'll be a lot of discussions and we can go into the details, discuss more about the details. So I'll have a very, very brief motivation. Again, I think the previous speakers have done a good job of sort of motivating why we're interested in looking at anti-de Sitter spacetimes. And then I'll sort of describe our approach to it, which is a little bit different, at least in terms of the technical details from a lot of what the other people have done. So I'll spend a little bit of time describing the basics, our initial approach. So eventually we want to look at five-dimensional asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, do simulations in global anti-de Sitter space. But just to make the problem tractable, we're restricting to SO3 symmetries to begin with. So essentially axisymmetric spacetimes in the bulk, corresponding to spherically symmetric symmetries on the boundary, or boundaries with or states with special conformal symmetry. And then I'll show you some early results where we started. Our initial data consists of large distorted black holes and see them ringing down to asymptotically AdS Schwarzschild black holes, looking at what is ostensibly a nonlinear phase of quasi-normal ring down. But for example, what a lot of the surprises that people have been speaking about in the last few days is that to a very good approximation, you could really describe the dynamics of the asymptotic part of the space-time using just quasi-normal modes. Essentially, the only nonlinearity that's evident is in mode mixing. And then I'll show the map to the state of the boundary using the AdS CFT. Okay, so my very brief motivation. I think the people here don't need the motivation, but essentially you're just to get started. And that's just to explore the gravity side of the AdS CFT correspondence, and at least in the limit where, so the strong coupled field theory, the large end limit, et cetera, where we expect that Einstein gravity is going to be a good approximation to the bulk theory. And sort of our approach is to use numerical methods, and well, one of the reasons is we'll be able to study situations where there's non-trivial bulk dynamics. So looking at things which are very far from presumably the linear regime, linear perturbations of black holes, where we really need numerical simulations to understand what's happening in the bulk. So what was our initial sort of primary goal was to look at geometries that are dual to models of quark-gluon plasma formation in heavy ion collisions. Now, this is sort of a long-term goal to get to that, because as I mentioned before, and as I'll go into more details, we're looking at symmetry-reduced situations. But of course, eventually, we'd like to apply it to non-central collisions, so those that show elliptic flow, et cetera. And that will require relaxing all the symmetries, so full five-dimensional simulations. But we're sort of, it'll be probably several years. I mean, numerical projects, unfortunately, aren't back of the envelope. They take a long time, so it'll take a few years to get to that point. Hopefully, that by that time, people are still interested in quark-gluon plasmas and this correspondence.
So, can I ask you, if that's a motivation, yeah, why do you want to
go to the AdS? Well, so that's the primary goal. But so, let me sort of, in some sense, the reason, okay, so again, this is, people have seen this before, so again, this is anti-de Sitter space in global coordinates. Not such a nice diagram as you had showed, but the motivation or the reason for using global coordinates is that we could, in principle, tackle a broader class of problems. So if we're only interested in eventually applying it to heavy ions, and what we can do is we can take our global simulation, pick a Poincaré wedge, and transform to the Poincaré patch on the boundary. So in some sense, the global space-time allows us to look at a larger class of problems. And so even though that was the initial goal, we just wanted to, there are many other interesting applications. And since then, the instability of AdS, things in just questions in pure gravity have sort of come up, and having a global code is, I think, at least from the point of view of having something that's more general purpose, is a better way to go. As opposed to vice versa, if you just had a code restricted to the Poincaré patch, you wouldn't really be able to answer questions in global AdS with that, whereas in this case, we can do both. One, just we pick the Poincaré career wedge that we want.
So numerically, I know that mathematically it can be done.
Yeah.
Numerically, is it do you think that's an efficient way of,
So you mean just in
global coordinates? Now you say, well, I want to transform back to Poincaré.
Yeah.
Then you may encounter all sorts of technical numerical problems that I can't imagine.
No.
It's just a conformal
transformation.
Right.
And
so
this I know, but when you talk about numerics, then people will start.
Yeah.
Thinking.
But the thing that's
the other way around.
Right.
If you start in the Poincaré and you try to go to Hubble, that's really, really difficult.
Right. So
I mean, you tell me that it's no problem numerically, then I believe you.
In principle, the thing that can be tricky with, so it's when you do a coordinate transformation, you've got the solution. That's the difficult part. Now, the subset of coordinate transformations that you can do numerically where you're not changing time slicing, that's trivial. If you wanted to do a coordinate transformation where the new time is different from the time that you used in your thing, then that can be really tricky.
Yeah, that's what I
mean. Well, in some sense, because the way that we're prescribing our boundary conditions, that's essentially, it's going to, the global time on the boundary is the Poincaré time. So we're sort of fixing the boundary. We're keeping that rigid. And so the only question is, well, how are we sort of extending that slice into the interior? I'm not going to go show any details of this, but for example, with the quasi-normal modes, we do see signs of a gauge mode. And so we sort of get a spherically symmetric mode, which shouldn't be there. It should be a pure gauge mode. And presumably, we'd get rid of it if we could transform to a gauge that was exactly the same as the perturbative calculations. So there are some artifacts like that. But at least, I think, for example, that the leading order question that we can ask here is, what is the stress-energy tensor of the dual state? I think that's...
The other problem that I see is that while it's true that you can solve the boring global EDS and read it off with a Poincaré patch, mm-hmm. perhaps, for example, the way you specify the initial state, something that looks natural, if you do it in global EDS, it's completely unnatural in the other one, and vice versa.
Right. So that's a good point. And actually, so we also think like perhaps getting to look at non-central heavy ion collisions. What might be a natural way to set up initial conditions? And we thought, well, soliton or black hole collisions. And it seems like it's more natural to set that up in global ADS. So for example, we can take start here, just put out two solitons or black holes close to the boundary. They're going to have a lot of momentum. They're going to collide. And then that's going to form a single black hole that's going to ring down. I mean, that seems to be very, for me, an intuitive way to set up initial data that at least hand wavy, you'd think that that might be a good model to heavy ion collisions. Now, I'm sure that, there is, of course, an equivalent description in the Poincaré patch, but it seems a bit strange. Even single black holes are a little bit strange in the Poincaré patch, where they come from a past horizon, they move to some distance, and then they leave the Poincaré patch. So even a single black hole looks a bit strange. So how would you set up a sort of a dual collision? I'm sure that there is a mapping, but it seemed that this would be an easy way to do it.
There is probably more dramatic thing that I don't think it will work if you start putting deformation, if you start putting scalars and turning on the, going away from a conformal field theory of the boundary, then that's a physically inequivalent system, whether you do it in a Poincaré patch or you do it in a
right.
I don't think in that case, If you eventually want to go close to sort of more realistic,
right? So you mean deforming the boundaries,
you cannot just simply coordinate trend, take a solutions in your global ADS
you'd want to what you need to do in the global. So it won't be global ADS; it would be deformed global ADS. And presumably, you could choose things that will match the physics that you want in the Poincaré patch.
It's just different. There are physically equivalent.
There's no conformal. I think what he's alluding to, there's no conformal symmetry. So the conformal map would not.
Let's just take from. So in some sense, what are you saying that if you look at a deformed boundary or something that's not exactly ADS, but some deformed boundary on a Poincaré wedge, that you can embed that into some global?
Yes, that's right. That's a statement.
It's impossible.
Yes.
Really?
You're thinking it's a patch of your Poincaré space, of your ADS space,
and how could it break?
So you'll have similar boundary conditions in the global-like space-time. It's not global ADS, but it's global deform.
I think ultimately it's all related to the fact that when you go, at least in a conformal case, from the pointer FH to the global ADS, you have to change your time.
But the boundary doesn't change.
No, but that's in, and changing time, it means that you're also changing the conjugate property, which is a Hamiltonian.
But close to the boundary, the two times are the same, right?
But the issue is not close to the boundary. I mean, what I'm just saying is, suppose you take n equals 4 to play a mute and you deform it. It's conformal, you deform it by you deform it in a way that it changes the infrared. For example, if you combine the geometry, that cannot be,
you can never put it
as a piece of global energy.
You can
stop. Interested in the long term, for example, you might want to collide two lumps of energy at the bottom of a geometry that's confined. So you could do that.
Okay.
That you cannot describe, I think, in global ADS. It will be just a different problem.
But what is the correspondence there? What is the bulk geometry that is dealt to?
It's just a field theory on a sphere in a box. So you study a non-conformal field theory on a sphere versus conformal field theory in a flat space time. So the physics of those two models are different. They are not related, like in the case of the CFT, but it's
That sounds very bizarre to me. But are you thinking now of theories where you're getting rid of the bulk? You just got a boundary, and you've got a theory. What is the bulk then?
Well, the bulk is something that asymptotically looks like ADS in the boundary patch.
Yeah.
And when you go deeper into the geometry, it's no longer ADS. It's a deformation of ADS.
Sure, but. And how is that inconsistent with, unless you're saying that on the Poincaré wedge it becomes singular in some geometric sense, so that the space-time is not defined. But so now, I mean, if you take this Poincaré wedge and now take a time slice through it and now do a Cauchy problem.
Imagine you take the Poincaré wedge. Mm-hmm. You know what surfaces of constant R look like?
Yeah.
So you cut the geometry off
right.
The surface of constant R, and that's your entire space-time, effectively.
You don't have more beyond.
So there's just nothing beyond the bunker.
But in principle, then you'd be able to, like, in a global picture, then that would just, you could say, well, let there be a, that surface then be a boundary.
Yeah.
Only going to require here that it's asymptotically ADS. Inside, I mean, it's going to have its own dynamics. Yeah. And so
but you'd have to cut it off.
But it can be fashioned as a question of singularities as well. So some geometry that would be singular, deformed geometries that would be singular on a Poincaré patch would become non-singular in global ADS. So that's probably the right explicit example of that, which is sort of a way to say that there shouldn't be a coordinate change that would allow you to move from one to another.
I'd like to discuss this more, but perhaps, just for the sake of, let's...
We can pick this up tomorrow afternoon. We'll have a session to discuss.
This is an interesting question. I'd like to understand it more, but okay. In any case, we're looking at global ADS right now. We want to solve the Einstein equations in space-times that are asymptotic to global ADS. So Einstein equations, negative cosmological constants, stress energy. And at this stage, we're using a scalar field. We actually have written here with a potential, but we've got a massless scalar field, so no potential. And we want to do this with a generalized harmonic form of the field equations with constraint damping. I'll show that on the next slide. At this stage, the only reason why we're adding the scalar field is as a mechanism to create black holes. So for simplicity, we're going to look at time-symmetric initial data. And we're going to take some lumps of scalar field energy, make them very, very dense, such that essentially on the initial time slice, they're trapped surfaces. And essentially, the trapped surface is going to contain all of the scalar field. So to a very good approximation, the dynamics is essentially vacuum GR. So the scalar field right now has got nothing to do with any dual operators on the boundary. It's just a mechanism to create black holes in these space-times. So the generalized harmonic form of the field equation looks as follows. I don't want to go too much into the details of it, but perhaps it's the motivation why use generalized harmonic, and it was purely because this is what works well. It's one of the two known examples that works well for generic scenarios in four-dimensional asymptotic space-time. So the generalized harmonic and BSSN formalisms. And so without, you know, in some sense, without trying to reinvent the wheel, just saying, well, what might work in asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space-time? Well, let's try the same approach. So what generalized harmonic coordinates does, so we take the Einstein equations and we impose this condition that the covariant wave operator acting on a space-time coordinate, each space-time coordinate is equal to some prescribed source function H. And if you substitute this condition, this gradient, into the field equations, essentially you reorganize the terms such that the principal parts, so the key thing here is you want to treat these as independent functions. And so the principal parts of the field equation, so the terms that include second derivatives become essentially just a wave equation for each of the metric elements. So you recast the field into a form which is manifestly hyperbolic. So this is, in some sense, you've enlarged the system of equations by introducing these independent functions. But of course, we're only interested in solutions to the system of equations which have this constraint equal to zero. And so there, at the analytic level, there are theorems that say, well, just based on the way in which this propagates, if you choose initial conditions where this is initially zero and its first time derivative is zero, and you have boundary conditions that are consistent, then this will stay zero for all time if you evolve the system using the set of equations. That's not true at the numerical level. The truncation errors are generally going to introduce violations, and typically they can grow exponentially. So this is the Einstein equations. This is the Einstein tensor bit. This set of terms are so-called constraint damping terms. So you can see that they're homogeneous in these constraints. So any solution to the field equations that has C equals zero, this set of terms vanish. But what these constraint damping terms are designed to do is if you start to have some non-zero Cs, that they exponentially damp them. And there's no proof that it works generically. There are a couple of parameters that you can adjust. But empirically, at least in asymptotically flat cases, and in some of the cases that we've looked at with a 5D black string and with in this asymptotic, in the examples that I'm showing you, this actually does work. So if you adjust these parameters appropriately, you can control them.
So you use a certain set of numbers for flat space. Do these numbers change a lot when you go to the ABS case, or you use the same set of numbers for this?
A similar set. They don't change much. Okay. They don't need much fine-tuning in the sense that there's some constraint. I think this one has to be between 0 and 1. And typically, the scale of this has to be, it's got to be essentially relevant, so 1 over some characteristic length scale in the problem.
One more question. Are these H functions something you choose a priori, once and for all?
So you have to then specify, that becomes your, you can think of it as your coordinate degrees of freedom. And so you have to choose either, you have to add some a set of equations that, new evolution equations for them. You can set them algebraically. I'll sort of describe what we do asymptotically. I won't show exactly what we do in the interior. This is how you encode your coordinate degrees of freedom. So you have to specify additional conditions or equations for those source functions. So
why did you pick this? I don't understand the significance.
That's just, I guess, from experience with asymptotically flat, four-dimensional cases. And the one reason also was we eventually do want to study generic situations where there are no symmetries. So in asymptotic, in four-dimensional asymptotically flat case, if you have restricted symmetries, there are many schemes that people have used in the past that work. But when you don't make any restrictions on symmetries, so it's just general four-dimensional evolution, the vast majority of ways of writing the field equations, even those that are mathematically well-posed, have all forms of Einstein equations have these constraints that you satisfy that initial time and then you evolve forwards in time. And they generically have constraints that grow exponentially with time.
But
so
also, if you go back to, say, the ADM equations, that is known to be completely ill-formed. That would be the worst thing you could use to evolve it numerically space-time. Right. So the first choice gives you the best possible way. You can write the system of questions in symmetric hyperbolic, so you buy that. And then the next one is an addition to it that will now guarantee the constraint to be done.
Right.
So and you put you in the best possible way to try to start.
Yeah, and so together there are two methods, this generalized harmonic and the BSSN, and I guess Masaru is going to talk about that in his talk. So it's like, okay, pick one of those. We don't know that it's necessarily going to work in asymptotic ADS, but since that works in flat space, let's try that to start with. And again, if we had looked at symmetry reduced situation, there are other ways. Or, for instance, that if you have and this is going to be a Cauchy-based evolution, if you're looking at sort of characteristic style evolution, then you know what Alex spoke about yesterday, what Chesler and Yafida do, that works well as well. But those methods don't generalize very easily, at least not in generic situations, to situations with less symmetry. Okay, so I think that's all that I wanted to say here. Okay, so this is at least just in bare form. Though, of course, there's several. We're not going to actually. So we eventually want to solve for the metric, but we're not going to do it exactly in the variables in their bare forms because of the singularities in ADS, and so we have to regularize the coordinates and the variables. Let me just briefly sort of show you the steps that we take to do that. So first, we want to cover the entire space-time, so the radial coordinate goes to infinity, but we want a coordinate that's finite, so we just introduce this rho coordinate. So the origin is at rho equals 0, the boundary is at rho equals 1. This is just some length scale, let's just set it to 1, so that's not the ADS length scale. But so we introduce a compactified radial coordinate, rho that goes from 0 to 1. And in some of the expressions, I'll also show a coordinate q, which is just 1 minus rho. So the boundary is at rho equals 1 or q equals 0. Again, in this first study, we can restrict to actually symmetric bulk spacetimes. And we're going to choose coordinates that are adapted to that. So we've got our time coordinate, our radial coordinate. We're going to have one angular coordinate. And then the other two angular coordinates, we're just going to explicitly factor out in this form. So the ADS, plane ADS space-time in these coordinates takes on this form. Now, of course, the metric, of course, it's formally singular as you approach the boundary. But the boundary is essential here in the evolution. So we really need, we wanted, it's not like in an asymptotically flat situation where you can say, well, let's just make the domain large and we don't have to worry about infinity. Yeah, we have to include the infinity, but it's a formally singular problem, so we have to regularize the variables. And there's several steps that we go through. So first, so this is the bare metric. We're going to write it as the divergent ADS piece plus a deviation, and this is not necessarily small, I'm just using the symbol. And similarly, the source functions in ADS form, in the form that we want, they're non-zero and they're singular, but we're going to factor out the singular ADS bit and then the difference. Then, if we look at the second thing that we want to choose, we want to have a form of the radial coordinate, which is, we have to choose the radial coordinate asymptotically. And so we're going to choose something which is the standard Pfefferman-Gram-like radial coordinate. And so then if we look at what the leading order behavior is of the metric as we approach the boundary, there's a particular, power series in 1 over R. And so based on this, what we're going to do is we're going to factor out enough powers of this radial coordinate and then evolve a variable that we could put a simple Dirichlet condition on the boundary. So just going back to our rho coordinate now, so this is just the R coordinate transforming to the rho coordinate. This is essentially what we're doing. So again, this is the bare variable. This is the singular ADS bit. This barred variable, this is the actual variable that we're going to evolve in the code. And what we've done is we factored out sufficient powers of 1 minus rho here, or q, such that the leading order behavior of every single barred variable is a simple Dirichlet condition as we approach the boundary. So if we Taylor expanded any boundary, any barred variable, the leading behavior would be q plus q squared, etc. So we do that for both the metric, or sort of the metric, the source function, and the scalar field.
So this H satisfies a certain equation, right, that you prescribe.
Yeah.
How do you know that that equation is compatible with the Pfefferman-Gram expansion?
that's tricky. So, I'll get to the next. That's going to be my fourth point. The next slide. So I'll let me just quickly finish this slide, and then I'll show that. So the boundaries, the ADS boundary is formally singular, but because we're looking at axisymmetric spacetimes, and we have coordinates that are adapted to this symmetry, we also have a formally singular boundary on the axis. And so these factors of 1 plus rho and the rho sine squared, et cetera, are just the same argument so that we have regular variables on axis. So in any case, so we take these definitions, we plug them into the field equations, the scalar equation for the wave equation for the scalar field, and so we evolve the barred variables in the code with the boundary conditions.
I'm sorry, that's more
question. Oh yeah, sure.
From a test up.
No.
Instead of good. Subtracting, why don't you divide? For instance, why don't you take GTT to be GTT bar over GTT ADS, and then GTT bar would go to 1 at the boundary. Why is it better to do it this way?
That might be a way to do it. The one, at least the one way in which we thought this might be better is if you look at the Einstein tensor.
Right.
So again, we want to substitute this. Oops, going the wrong way. We want to substitute in this set of equations. So if we write it as a sum, then automatically the ADS bit's going to be a solution, so that's going to vanish. So that's the most divergent piece. If we take, so we have things that go like 1 over r squared, we take second derivatives, no, so that's the most divergent piece that's going to cancel. Then we're going to have terms that are going to be the ADS bit times the delta. So that's going to be slightly less divergent, but they all better somehow cancel. But that's what we're going to have to solve for. And then we're going to have terms that are regular. I think if you divided them out, you wouldn't have such a clean cancellation at the initial level.
Elliptic setup. Where we try to find solutions that have no time dependence. Mm-hmm. Subtracting is not good.
But elliptic is very difficult.
I know. That's what I'm saying. At least in the elliptic setup, it's very bad.
Yeah.
It's very bad to do that numerically. I don't understand why.
Right. But at least that was sort of our reasoning. And
okay.
I don't know. That's. I'm sure both ways could probably be made to work. But. Okay. So this then brings you to the other question. So this is the requisite falloff that's consistent with the Pfefferman-Gram type expansion. Yeah.
Do you describe the HADS algebraically?
Yeah. Right. So we just take this solution. So these are the coordinates that we want. This is the consistent with the Pfefferman-Gram, and you just evaluate what box X is for these coordinates, and that gives you the H for ADS. Okay, but you think of these H's as your source, as your gauge degrees of freedom. So if we factored this out, you'd think that these are arbitrarily specified functions, but they're not. And we're not exactly sure why. So the last thing is we have to choose the asymptotic form. So we can choose essentially whatever we want in the interior for regular evolution. I haven't said it, but what we do in the interior is we start with there's some value of the H bars that we get from our initial data, and then we just relax to harmonic in the interior. So H bar goes to 0 in the interior. But for whatever reason, H bar is not arbitrary on the boundary. And it's not just the constraint or evolution equations. There's something else going on there that we don't quite understand yet. It would be nice if we had a systematic way of figuring out the boundary conditions for the source functions. Because when we reduce symmetries, or if you want to do some deformations on the boundary, we essentially have to go through this procedure before. But what we do is sort of look at the asymptotic form of the field equations. That gives some guidance, but then the rest is just pretty much trial and error. And so this is the set of asymptotic conditions that these H bars have to satisfy, at least what we found, to get stable evolution. Now, I don't think they're unique, and I can't exactly argue why, but at least that's what we had to do. And if people have some more insight into why there is this particular restriction, it would be very useful to know.
Is this table of small variations of those fractions?
No.
So if you pick 5.1.
Well, okay. So I'm not sure how at some level, it would be sufficiently small that it probably would be stable. The growth of the instability would be controlled. But so we haven't tested small perturbations, but.
If you put 3 instead of 5 caps.
Yeah, then it's unstable. So.
And there is no framework to choose 5 caps. So.
Right. So for perhaps another way of saying it. Sorry. Unstable is perhaps the wrong word here, in the sense that what seems to happen is okay. We choose initial data that's consistent with the desired falloff for the metric and the source functions in the scalar field. Now, during evolution, we want to preserve that falloff. So if you choose arbitrary source functions, the h-bars that are consistent with that falloff, they generically, the evolution of the metric could evolve away from that desired behavior. So it's still going to be a solution to the field equations. It's still consistent. But the leading order behavior in those coordinates is going to be different from the desired Pfeffermann-Gram. And so because we factored out just as many powers as is necessary, what happens in the evolution is that the metric wants to diverge as you approach the boundary. It starts to diverge like 1 over Q. And so it seems that there's a subset of possible gauge choices that preserve the desired evolution, the desired falloff of the metric variables.
But isn't this just a consequence? I mean, you can see H bar is setting your coordinate system.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you're enforcing your coordinate system to go to a Pfeffermann-Gram expansion. This
right.
is a particular coordinate system.
Right.
So no wonder that you have to.
Right. Right. So
to choose H bar to be such
but,
that.
But in some sense, we thought that this would be enough.
No.
So.
If you try to make a wave-like operator
so,
for
or perhaps or perhaps said in a different way, we actually. We just want the metric to have this leading order falloff. It doesn't have to be exactly Pfeffermann-Gram in terms of the leading order coefficients.
Yeah, but coefficients.
This
has my source terms, right? That come
yeah.
At a lower order, which is.
So that, I guess that is effectively
that's,
what's happening. Because
yeah.
if you do the perturbative expansion at each, it's not a clean order
right.
by order expansion. You mix between the orders. So that that might be, I guess, another way of describing why it's this
but,
doesn't happen. But
have you tried to give, say, a wave-like equation for these ages? Given a dependent equation for this, don't prescribe them. Give an additional equation that tells them how they move, how they propagate in ADS.
We haven't
given a well-defined way of knowing what the boundary conditions are close to the boundary.
We haven't tried something like a wave equation.
A wave equation in natural coordinates on this space. I think this might help you with finding a systematic way of knowing what happens.
Perhaps.
Close
maybe,
to the boundary.
Maybe, so you say like a wave equation, of let the H bar satisfy a wave equation.
Or for the ages even.
Well, so that doesn't work. So it.
But then for H bar.
Yeah. So we've tried, we've sort of tried letting H bar go to zero. That doesn't work. So it's just, so it's exactly the structure of ADS.
Yeah.
That doesn't work. But again, there's. Yeah, it would be nice to have a systematic way and perhaps also explore more of them, but we just haven't done that much.
So is this choice of asymptotic of H bars, is it sensitive to the mass of the scalar? So in your case, it's a massive scalar. Now if I put a massive scalar, would they change 5 caps to some other number?
Yes. Or
it depends on
probably,
mass,
probably
right?
yeah. So we've started to look at adding scalars that deform the behavior, and essentially you have to repeat all of this.
Right.
So this leading order bit changes, this bit definitely changes, and I'm not 100% sure if those constants change. So Hans has been looking at this, but they, I think generically they will. I'm not sure if they have in the simple cases that we've looked at so far.
It depends on the mass of the scalar field.
Yeah. So it's definitely the powers are going to change,
exactly.
And probably the coefficients as well. Then that's where right now it's a very unsatisfactory way of getting at these conditions. So we can, from the form of the field equations, like this one is just it pops out immediately. It has to be that. But some of the others, there's more freedom, and so it's trial and error, and that's not a nice way to go. But at least with this ANSATs. For spherical symmetry or axisymmetry, it works. Okay, so after all of those definitions, we plug it into the equations, and then we discretize the equations using standard finite difference methods, so second order accurate finite difference. We sort of discretize those equations directly, so we don't introduce auxiliary variables, so we just technically require three time levels. So we're going to look at situations, essentially all the situations we're going to look at have black holes, and one reason is for that. Well, black holes are interesting, but also just technically, because we're using spherical polar coordinates, the origin's a problem. There's a severe Courant condition if you wanted to include evolution with the origin. So the time step you'd have to take is very small. So the convenient thing is to just put a big black hole there, it gets rid of the origin, and so we can take reasonable time steps. And so we excise a region inside the event horizon based on the apparent horizon. We need dissipation. We have support for mesh refinement, but all the simulations that I'm showing you now is just unigrid. So the only thing I'm going to say about initial data is here. So let me just say in words how we construct initial data. I mentioned before we're going to look at time symmetric initial data. So it's a moment of time symmetry on our t equals zero slice. So all the time derivatives vanish. I mentioned if we want consistent solutions to the field equations, we require those C's and C dots to be zero, the constraints. What's equivalent is if you set C equal to zero and solve the traditional Hamiltonian and momentum constraints in the ADM formalism. So with time symmetric initial data, the nice thing is the momentum constraints are trivially satisfied. They're zero. So the only equation that we have to solve is a Hamiltonian constraint. And the way we do it is very similar to the ways that have been developed in the asymptotically flat case with this York-Lichnerowitz style decomposition. And so what we say for the ansatz for the metric, we give some scalar field energy, so that's going to deform the bulk geometry. And we say let the geometry be conformal to ADS, the spatial geometry. And that gives an elliptic equation for the conformal factor. We solve for that, and then we reconstruct the five-dimensional geometry together with the time symmetry condition that gives us the consistent initial condition for the harmonic evolution. So the interesting thing about that in ADS is that when we follow this approach, we can very easily create arbitrarily large black holes, which is in contrast to the asymptotically flat case where in this approach at some point the equations become non-unique, and it's sort of close to the point where trapped surfaces start to form. So just sort of to show you in ADS, that's not the case. So this is so in this case, we take a spherically symmetric lump of scalar field in the bulk and just varied the amplitude. And so this is the asymptotic mass of the space-time as a function of the amplitude. So you can see initially it's sort of quadratic in the amplitude. In the asymptotically flat case, that's about as large as you'd be able to get solutions for, just at the point where trapped surfaces start to form. So that's where the black dots come in. So the open circles are the ADMS. When we have sufficiently large distributions of energy, we also see trapped surfaces, and the black dot shows the mass as given by the area of the apparent horizon. And so this is just sort of a zoom in. So you can see that at least in this case, they're slightly smaller than the asymptotic mass because there's a little bit of scalar field outside. But this is the same characteristic size scalar field. So as we start making the amplitude larger, the trapped surface grows, and that's why they sort of asymptote towards the same number. So eventually, for the sufficiently large amplitudes, it's essentially a vacuum black hole that we create. Almost all of the scalar field energy is interior to the black hole. And from a sort of formal mathematical point of view, if you look at so we want to apply a maximum principle to the Hamiltonian constraint that says when you expect solutions. It turns out the cosmological constant here helps. It allows us to get these large amplitude initial data, which is nice in that we don't have to do anything other than just crank up the amplitude of the scalar field to get black holes. Okay, so the first application Well, the only application that I'm going to discuss is the quasi-normal ring down of highly distorted black holes. So at least at that previous graph, it was spherically symmetric data, so it was just going to form a spherically symmetric black hole, no ring down. But we can also put in a distorted profile and form a distorted black hole, and so we want to explore the quasi-normal ring down modes. And just a very brief review, as you know, you've heard a bit about today, and we'll probably talk a lot more about it in other talks. The gravitational and scalar perturbations, they exhibit quasi-normal decay. In general, as we mentioned in the previous talk, you know, they're scalar, vector, and tensor modes of the metric. For the scalar field, they're only scalar modes. However, because we're in axisymmetry, it turns out we can only excite the scalar modes of the metric. We can't excite any vector and tensor modes. So for those scalar modes, so the quasi-normal modes, we can, you know, decompose them into, you know, the spherical harmonics on S3. And so a general quasi-normal mode will have this structure. There'll be some radial function, angular function, and a complex exponential. Well, this is going to be real, but essentially it's easier to write in terms of a complex exponential. And usually with the ADS CFT, sort of applying this ADS CFT dictionary, it's sort of the decay time of this mode that's often been said to be of relevance in these heavy ion collisions as sort of being the thermalization or equilibration time. There's a lot of perhaps thermalization in quotes here. It's more perhaps an equilibration time scale. So just to, again, remind you, and especially for the relativists like me, who's always find this confusing about, or unusual about ADS black holes, is that they are actually fast and slow modes. So in the, you know, the usual asymptotically fat case, you've got a black hole of a certain size that sets a characteristic scale. And so you only have these slow modes in astrophysical black holes because essentially this is the scale of the problem. And so any sort of vibration of the space-time, you expect to have frequencies that are roughly in this regime. On the other hand, with ADS black holes, they're also fast modes that the larger the black hole is, the faster they decay. And at least within this duality, the fast modes have sort of been interpreted as being associated with microscopic degrees of freedom, where the slow modes are perhaps the hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. The scalar field only has fast modes. Okay.
In which sense they are hydrodynamic? I mean, you are in a box, so the field theory doesn't have a hydrodynamic mode.
Sure. I mean, so I think. So I mean, you say on the boundary of a field theory on a sphere. Okay, so there's a maximum wavelength mode that can fit on the sphere, but I think you can perfectly make sensible hydrodynamics on the sphere, right? It's just... Yeah. Right.
Sorry?
Okay, so in any case, the reason for which we're showing this, what we're going to do is we're going to start with black holes. And so the understanding of these quasi-normal modes is this is valid in the perturbative regime. So we perturb the horizon, and the resulting metric can be written as a sum of these modes and the asymptotic behavior of the space-time. So we want to test, you know, at what point does this picture break down? Can we make a perturbation that's sufficiently large that at least initially, writing the perturbations as a sum of quasi-normal modes doesn't make sense, but eventually we expect that the perturbations will get sufficiently small that this description is valid.
Sorry, can I ask, what do you mean by it doesn't make sense to write a perturbation? This is, maybe where I want to see some mathematically precise, but is this sort of a basis? You can always write down the perturbation as a sum of
quasi-normal modes. I don't think that's a complete basis.
So that's what we were wondering. Yeah. So is there a theorem? So there is no branch cut, so then the standard law is that there is a deformed basis. You see a theorem that says so? The opposite is true. So if there is a branch cut, they don't form a basis.
That's right.
But like an asymptotically fat space, they don't form a basis.
The Green's function has this branch cut. But in ADS,
okay. there is no branch cut.
At leading order in N.
Right.
The
question is, so we know that if there is a branch cut, they cannot form a basis. It's the opposite, but if you don't see a branch cut, will they form a basis?
Yeah, I don't know of any term that they're using.
Is it? Good to know.
But I think this is more, I think what Francis is also saying is that you could see nonlinear effects that are not in the quasi-normal ones, which actually I think you do see, right?
In terms of your mode mixing.
You could have multiple.
Yeah. But also, so it's, I mean, if the quasi-normal modes do form a complete basis, of course, then it's just, you just do the decomposition.
No, you can always do the decomposition, but that doesn't mean they will evolve independently.
Right.
You can always
only
but if the system is not linear.
But only if it's, only if this forms a complete basis.
Yeah.
Right. So in some sense, what you then do is you'd have your solution. Say in some early times it's not described by this. Well, you do your decomposition, you'll get your spectrum, but there'd be a residual. There'd be some piece of the metric variation that hasn't been captured by the sum of modes. That, I guess that's sort of the question.
My intuition is that that's not there, but I don't know.
Right.
I wouldn't be able to do that.
No, but there are some
there
are some quasi normal modes that are
quasi
normal, but what we observe is that start making slow changes of your scalar field, for example, on a scale where you cannot excite. So there is a gap in the spectrum of quasi-normal modes. And so those things relax in the power mode. So they do not relax to the quasi-normal mode. So that's a particular excitation that if you set up that as initial condition, there is no way you could
write
some of quasi-normal mode.
And yeah, I mean, so ADS is a bit different, but also if you think of the asymptotically flat case, I mean, we can take a horizon and we can feed energy in on some small times, on a very slow time scale. So now if you look at the perturbation, it's not going to be a sum of decaying exponentials. I mean, we can essentially feed in modes that excite whatever spectrum. At one point, if we stop the excitation, then they're going to start quasi-normal decaying. But if we say, well, can we write the entire history of the perturbations of the space-time as a sum of those modes, and you can't. Now here we're in a box. So you know, perhaps that changes things, but I'm not sure it's an obvious. At least it's not obvious to me that.
But then, if quasi-normal modes are not a basis, why do they characterize the ring down when the perturbation is small? You could also make the same argument. I can put a small perturbation in amplitude, but in such a way that I cannot expand it.
That argument you could apply also in the asymptotic flat case.
Yeah.
And we know solutions that are not describable by quasi-normal modes and represent a black hole that is decaying short.
I mean, there are Robertson-Trautmann solutions in ADS, right?
Are they?
I think they
exist.
Robertson-Trautmann solutions.
Yeah.
There are, right? Yeah, there are Robertson. So I would suspect that those guys cannot be describable in terms of the quasi-normal mode. I just don't know if they exist in, do they exist in global or only?
Well, that I don't know, because in ADS you have these quasi-normal modes that do not oscillate, they just decay exponentially.
Right.
And that's a problem in the asymptotic flat case.
That's what
in this case exponentially,
track.
But it doesn't
oscillate.
So maybe you can.
But I know that this, I just don't think they exist in the global case.
They should exist also for global.
But
they exist.
Do this in global?
In global also.
Yeah.
Mm.
Then it would be interesting to see if they're discoverable by these.
Yeah. So on the other hand, it seems like. We can describe them, as I'll show. Well, I won't show the quasi-normal modes, but let me just show you an example of one of these simulations. So so now we're going to take our scalar field. So before it was just a spherically symmetric Gaussian, but now we're going to deform it in such a way that it's asymmetric shape. So here what I'm showing you is, so this is the coordinate domain. This is the axis of symmetry. So the color and the height represents the amplitude of the field. This is the boundary, so this is rho equals 1. So if you want to imagine this distribution, just sort of spin it around the symmetry axis. So you can see this is sort of a pancake. It's an oblate distribution of the scalar field. So we're going to form a non-spherical black hole. Again, it's a large amplitude distribution. So when I start the animation, immediately you'll see this sort of black hemisphere pop into existence, and that's the excision surface. So we find the apparent horizon, which is going to be some distance there, and we cut out the piece of the domain that's some distance inside the apparent horizon. But of course, because this is an exponential tail, even though it's dynamically insignificant, there's still going to be some scalar field energy left over. And that's what I'm going to show you, the animation of the color scale is continually going to be adapting to the magnitude of the field, just so you can see what happens. So there's the black hole. Now this is the remnant field. If you notice, the amplitude is very small now. It started of order unity. It's now 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. But now you can see this the scalar field that's decaying. And so I guess the interesting thing that this showed is like the property that was mentioned this morning, that the higher L modes have slower decay. So the total amplitude is dropping. It's now 10 to the minus 10. It's going down. But the larger L modes have a slower decay, and so they're now revealing themselves. And presumably, you know, this eventually it will be a complete mess, even though it will be a very small amplitude perturbation. So this shows the near boundary behavior. So taking the scalar field, dividing by Q, so getting the near boundary behavior. And this is essentially just the fast mode. So you can see it decays very rapidly. If we go to a logarithmic plot, we sort of get the decay that you expect. Here's now an example of one of the metric components. It's all the metric components have similar types of behaviors. I'm just going to show you one of them. This is sort of the metric component in one of the angular direction. And so in this case, so the black hole forms is now going to settle down to an ADS Schwarzschild. So we get a non-trivial solution here. So the scale is now, so it's fixed. But the near boundary, or the deviation from this is still exhibiting, you know, the quasi-normal ring down. Again, if we take the near boundary behavior sort of divided by Q, this is the oscillation that we get for the near.
A question. So the initial profile had an entire collection of modes, L modes. So they were
essentially, yeah. So we it's a Gauss. So essentially all even L modes.
Oh, okay. So
yeah. So right. So it does have, it's dominated by L equals 2. But it has a whole spectrum of L modes. So there is a fast mode there, but it's essentially it dies in this little time segment. And so what you're seeing here is sort of the sum of all the other quasi-normal modes for this component. And it's actually dominated by the L equals 2 mode. So I'm actually not going to show the pictures of the spectrum. So let me just say in words what we see. So for even the largest deformations that we've looked at, actually, let me just show you this next plot, just to show you the size of the deformation. So to show that this is not just a perturbation, what I'm plotting here is for various cases, the ratio of the equatorial to polar circumference of the black hole. So a black hole asymptotically goes to 1. For example, if you geometrically had a flat disk, it would be pi by 2, so 1.57. So in the most asymmetric case we've looked at, we actually, the geometry is sort of much more deformed than a flat disk. So we start with very large perturbations of the apparent horizon geometry. It settles down to a spherical black hole. But essentially from, you know, from very close to t equals 0, we can describe it as a sum of quasi-normal modes. This also appears to be a gauge mode. And this was getting back to, you know, what kind of slicing do we have of the space-time. And at least, for example, how we know, why we suspect it's a gauge mode, well, we do get consistency with the field equation. So we're converging to a solution. But for example, we have a spherically symmetric mode that decays exponentially. So we're calling that a gauge mode because, you know, that at least, you know, perturbing around a given black hole, that is just a gauge mode. So we seem to have a gauge mode. We've got the usual quasi-normal modes. And then for the higher L numbers, so at L equals 4, we start to see a mode mixing. So we see a combination of the fundamental mode and a frequency doubled L equals 2 mode.
Have you computed some invariant so that just to see that gauge mode goes away? Did you plot that on here?
No. What kind of invariant are you thinking of?
Neumann-Penrose scale.
No, we haven't done that yet. Yeah.
Well, Neumann-Penrose, remember, this is 5D.
Oh, they're all well studied. Harvey Rial and Matiko Tausker.
Right. So we just haven't.
For appealing theorems and so on for Python.
Yeah.
So they're all very well studied now.
Right. So yeah, so we haven't known. So I mean, in principle, it's actually, so that mode is pretty small, and it's actually kind of remarkable how close we are to the right gauge. So what we did, we sort of fixed the radial coordinate based on the aerial radius. So that's something that we can measure easily. It's just the time slicing, which we, in principle, we have a freedom to change the time slicing as well. We haven't done that. And so that's where we suspect where that comes from. But we haven't looked at any other invariants.
Does that mode show up when you compute boundary stress energy?
No.
Then that's
okay, right. So we have a, Well, so I'll show you the stress tensor. So we have this sort of the zero Casimir piece, but we just subtract off the piece, and that's consistent with what it should be for a spherical black hole. Okay, so yeah, that's the next one. Okay, so now I mean, we're solving just pure Einstein gravity, but now we want to apply this ADS CFT dictionary to say what it says about the boundary state. And the one piece of this dictionary that we're going to be applying is the is computing the expectation value of the stress tensor. So this is the formula. Because we're doing things on an S3, even ADS space has a boundary stress tensor, so we're just subtracting it off. So we subtract the ADS bit. And then this quantity is the Brown-York quasi-local stress tensor. So evaluated on some rho or Q equals constant surface. This is the extrinsic curvature of the surface, the intrinsic metric of the surface, the Einstein tensor on that surface, and then you take the limit where you approach the boundary. And then at least the duality says that this is the stress tensor of the boundary. So of the expectation value of the state on the boundary. So here are a couple of examples. So this, for example, is the TT component. And yeah, one of the mildly deformed cases. So on the boundary, we've just got this angular, non-trivial angular coordinate. So this is the angular coordinate. This is time. So you can see we start with a state where there's sort of a concentration. The units are arbitrary, but just the ratio 60 to 20. So it's sort of more concentrated on the equator, less concentrated at the poles. This oscillates, it sloshes around in the sphere, and eventually approaches a constant state. Here's one of the pressures, the chi pressure. It sort of has a similar type of behavior. And eventually the final state is consistent with the stress tensor of an ADS Schwarzschild black hole. So this is sort of the dual of the quasi-normal ringing in terms of the stress tensor on the boundary state.
In this picture, if you subtract the background, like the homogeneous, then yeah, you would see like this higher frequency becoming more and more different. Because the fluctuations in stress energy tensor are becoming
if you normalize them. So if you let's say we subtracted this, that's sort of what you're asking. So they still decaying, but the relative magnitude of the higher L numbers is growing relative to the lower one. So I guess if we plotted this and normalized it to the magnitude, you'd probably see that structure. I mean, we haven't done that, but yeah, you'd see them becoming relatively more important, even though the amplitude is decaying. So, oh yeah, and this is just the example for the extreme case that we looked at. So now going from like 0.7 to 220 and 0 to 35. So essentially a very high concentration of energy density and high concentration of pressure at the equators. And then this just sloshes around and eventually settles down to a black hole. So of course, this doesn't say that so asymptotically it's got to be a thermal state. We can compute these things regardless of what the state on the boundary is. If it's is it well described by hydrodynamics? Is it some state which is in local thermodynamic equilibrium or not? So the interesting question is: when does it actually start to behave like a stress tensor as predicted by this duality? And so this is the way that we're going to sort of test that. So the correspondence suggests, you know, at least if the state on the boundary is such that it has a thermal description or a hydrodynamic description, you should be able to write the stress tensor in a derivative expansion as we saw yesterday. So the leading order term is the ideal hydrodynamics, pressure, fluid velocity, energy density. Then we have viscosity at the next leading order, the shear tensor, and all these higher order terms at second order. But not only does the stress tensor take this form, but the various coefficients have a very particular relationship. So essentially, if we specify the energy density or the temperature, then all the transport coefficients are determined. So the way that we're going to, what we want to ask, well, again, as I said, at late times, the behavior of these oscillations should be consistent with this when they're small perturbations. But at what point do they start to become consistent? Especially given that we have pretty large deviations away from equilibrium, at least as judged by the energy density and the velocity. So the way we're going to test it, well, there are a few simple tests. Well, is the stress energy consistent with divergence, vanishing trace? It sort of has to be. But the more interesting test is we're going to see. So essentially what we're going to do is from our extracted boundary stress tensor and in axisymmetry, so projected onto the boundary, there are four independent components. And you can sort of think of it as the energy density, momentum, and two pressures. So a chi pressure and a two-sphere pressure. So we have four independent components. But what we're going to do is we're just going to take two of them and from that construct an energy density and a fluid velocity. And then, so we're going to construct those quantities and then compute the rest of these quantities. So based on the energy density and these relationships, we're going to get a temperature, and that's going to give us all the transport coefficients. And then.
I have been asking this before, but again, this setup is not on the speed.
So that's why it's expanding in the wild tensor around there.
Yeah. There's something that controls the radius of the sphere. That's the wild tensor. It's a curvature.
That one over there.
Boundaries conformally flat. What do you
do? Sorry?
Boundary is conformally flat. So what do you do?
Well, the wild tensor doesn't change. I mean, I think the valve tensor is zero because of what you just pointed out. It's conformally flat.
But is there even if I'm covering the
river? Yeah.
No, sure, I mean, the sphere is all over the place because of the covariant derivatives. That's right. But the power tensor specifically is zero.
So that temperature
freedom down is actually zero. Okay. So, this is just taken from the literature, the complete expression. Okay, so, so for any case, we're going to extract this from the, we're going to take the energy density, the four velocity. Again, from the four velocity, we can compute all of these other objects. And then we're going to compare order by order the full stress tensor with this reconstructed one, assuming this, assuming those relationships. Oh, and, so I showed you the energy density and the pressures before, and here's just an example of the velocity that we get on the boundary. So, for example, with this case with this asymmetry, it's a time symmetric initial data. So initially, the velocity is everywhere zero. In this case, the maximum velocities go to about 0.12. In the most asymmetric case, we've looked at the maximum velocities go to about half the speed of light. But in this case, also the velocity gradients are pretty large.
Right. So can you go back one slide?
Yeah. This one, or?
Where you had the thermal there. Okay. So you're going to try to read off epsilon and p and so on from the numerical simulations from the stress-energetic boundary.
Yeah.
But that numerical simulation is going to be a string of numbers. How do you know how to associate? I mean, what is
right? So at every point on the boundary, we're going to do this. So it's a function of chi and time. But so now at every function of time, we're going to compute this at every angular point on the boundary and compute an L2 norm of the difference between this, for instance, this expression and the actual bare quantities that we've extracted from the simulation. And that's what I'll be showing you in this next slide for the two cases. So this is the result. So we, for example, now taking one of the components of the pressure, so a theta-theta component of the pressure, the other things sort of look the same. So what this delta I equals zero is saying is we're taking the full expression of T theta-theta that we're getting from the simulation, taking the reconstructed, ideal hydrodynamic description, taking the difference and computing the L2 norm over the angles. What the black line in each curve is the result from our highest resolution simulation. And then the convergence results from the lower resolution simulations give us an uncertainty, a numerical truncation error estimate, and that's this gray area. So in some sense, our results are the black line to within this uncertainty. And so, for example, with this modest asymmetry case, essentially what it's saying is, so we take this and we divide it by the energy density to get a normalized expression. And it's saying that essentially in this case, that to within about 0.5%, the ideal description is good. So that the actual full stress tensor is consistent with just ideal hydrodynamics up to this, to about 0.5% level. Now, if we add ideal hydro plus viscous, the viscous terms, we get it to less than 0.5%. And essentially, when we go to the second order terms, essentially over the entire domain, except for at t equals 0, there's a little transient, which is we think is gauge. But essentially, over the entire domain, it's consistent with hydrodynamics. So this is perhaps a modest one, but more interesting is this most asymmetric case that we looked at. So now we do the same thing. So this says that now that ideal hydrodynamics is inconsistent to within about 3%, or it's consistent to within about 3%, which is actually pretty good. But the interesting thing is the trend. So now we add viscous hydro, it drops quite significantly. We go to second order, and to second order, essentially, even from again, basically t equals 0 to within about 0.5%, it's consistent. So, you know, that's, you know, prep, again, it's consistent with the fact that we can describe despite the violent distortions of the horizon, the near boundary behavior looks like quasi-normal modes. And correspondingly, well, what's actually interesting is that, well, of course, we can always compute a stress tensor, but to within, you know, 0.5%, the behavior of that stress tensor is that of this conformal fluid. Essentially, the trend is also interesting. As we add higher order terms, we get closer to consistency.
So this is quite different from, for example, the results by
Chen. Yeah.
They see order one deviation.
Right. And so the reason why, I think, is that we're starting with a large black hole. And so in some sense, I can imagine, like, so if you had, so there certainly are states that we don't expect to behave like a fluid. So say black hole formation. And so if we had an amount of time, we collapse the scalar field, then form a black hole, then it accretes to the final state. I can imagine that early bit is not going to show consistency. What's interesting here is what the difference here is, in some sense, we're starting with the final mass. Essentially, all of the mass is already in the black hole. There's not much accretion at all, but we're just distorting it. So I think that's the reason why there's a difference. So it's not,
if you actually form a black hole, but you have also a lot of fluid, a lot of scalar field outside, you expect this not to be so.
I think so. Yeah. So we haven't looked at that situation yet, but so I don't think it's inconsistent with what they're saying. But
I am surprised that.
Yeah,
I mean, a black hole, and you deform it so much.
Yeah.
That still fits.
Yeah. Right, but I think perhaps. Yeah, though what I also think is that, you know, states where it's not homogeneous, but where there's still local thermodynamic equilibrium. I mean, you can construct, well, at least in hydrodynamics, you can have states with large variations in temperature and energy density, you know, from point to point, but locally they're still in some sense in thermodynamic equilibrium. And so you'd expect that you'd be able to find, you know, if you have such states on your field theory, you'd be able to find such states in the bulk. And it's perhaps not surprising that they correspond to correspondingly deformed black holes. So I guess what it's saying is that this is a state where it's very inhomogeneous, but it's still, there's a notion of local thermodynamic equilibrium at each point.
What you're not doing is comparing saying is at each time slice, can I describe my stress tensor with this form?
But I didn't show a plot of this, but we also computed the divergence of the stress tensor. So if you want the evolution equation, and that is consistent to within truncation error. So
and that divergence is should be zero independently of whether you're in the hydrodynamic or not.
Yeah,
because we're solving the other. Right. But I guess just to say, in some sense, yeah, we're plotting this time by time, but the evolution is consistent with a hydro. It has to be, but it is. So we're not doing something very wrong.
This has to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a check on hydrodynamics. It's
to check on if we've done things correctly. Yeah. Okay, so the last thing that I want to show is now, okay, sort of like a first step to trying to make connection with hydrodynamic swimming. So this is one of these, okay, now we've got the global solution. Let's map to a Poincaré patch and see what we can say. So this is taking that most asymmetric solution, and we're going to take this part of the global space-time. So this is essentially half of the Poincaré wedge. So the full Poincaré patch, would have been this piece. So we're just going to start at t equals 0. We're not going to just do the regular transformation, but this is one of these, it's a special conformal transformation that Steve designed to actually try to get situations that even without explicitly putting deviations from symmetry that sort of allow you to break away from this Bjorken flow picture. So just basically, so the idea with this Bjorken flow is you've got these two heavy ions that they collide, and the idea is that once they pass through each other and this sort of gas of this fluid of quarks and gluons is left behind, that at least in a regime in the interior, there's translational invariance, but there's boost invariance in the direction of the collision. And that's just the sort of Bjorken flow picture. But the exact Bjorken flow solution, it's an infinite sort of plane. It's essentially two plane waves that collided, so not your ions. So in a realistic situation, there is some radial expansion. And so, of course, if you break symmetries, you can explicitly model that radial expansion. But this special conformal transformation that Steve invented essentially does that through conformal transformations. So it's like the conformal transformation does the work for you in trying to break this picture a little bit. So that's the transformation that we've applied. And this is, so we take this, we map it now. Now I'll show you a little animation of it. So this t equals 0 slice is this first frame of the animation. And so we've mapped it to this is the high density initial region. So that's this part of the year. This is the azimuthal coordinate. So just for effect, I've sort of spun it around. And then this is going to be the sort of the beam line. So here on the two sphere, they're expanding in this direction. Now they're going to be expanding outwards.
So is that expansion force invariant in your case or not?
No. So you'll, well, I mean, you can see, so that's what it looks like if we transform. So, at mid rapidity, there's a region in this interior where it does look approximately boost invariant, but it's definitely not throughout. Let me just play it again. So,
Yeah.
Right. So I think so this case, so Steve had an undergrad for his senior thesis look at, so the concluding side, what we want to do next is, if we want to actually connect it to the experiment, we want to at some point stop the hydrodynamics and model hydrodynamization by some prescription, for example, Cooper-Fry. And so the student did that, and it looks sort of reasonable, the spectrum. The problem with this simulation, so we can sort of think of this as some model of a central collision. But if you apply that model and you say, what's the effective gamma factor at which these things collide, it's something like 1.5. So that's very far from the kinds of gammas that we'd want.
Stupid question. Where is the horizon here? What is the black hole doing here?
So, this picture. So this is the case. This is this case. And so
where is it located?
It's in the bulk. So that picture is just the boundary.
Oh, no, sorry, that's just the boundary.
Yeah, just the boundary. Yeah.
Sorry.
So what controls the boundary?
If I can be able to here,
yeah.
Then you say, hydro works so well.
Yeah.
Then if you want to connect to heavy alkalines, why don't you just solve with normal hydrodynamics and not
That's a good point. And so yeah, so one of the things is relax the symmetries. But then after seeing how well it works, it's are we going to spend years and years getting a full 5D code just to confirm what the Hydra people are doing? And so I think at least post-thermalization, that's correct. But perhaps one thing where we can imagine, we can say something where the hydro, pure hydro can't be, is thermal, is answer the question about thermalization. And I guess that's like some of the stuff that, you know, Chesler and Yaffe have done and Hughes have done. So if we start with, let's imagine it is, the dual description would be two solitons colliding or two little black holes. Presumably, this excellent match to hydro will happen at some point when you already have the large single black hole that's starting to ring down. But before that, it won't be a hydro description. Now, I don't know, you can wave your hands whether that should be a model to actually what's happening in the pre-thermalization state of a heavy ion collision, but that might be something where we can give some.
Is that in that pre-thermalization state, by definition of pre, you should not expect hydrodynamics to work.
Yeah, but I guess the question, do you expect that this data CFT would be able to give you some insight into that, into
yeah,
that phase?
Yeah,
so,
but not that you should expect deviations from
hydrodynamics. Right. So that's why it's the hand wavy hope that we're not just repeating what the hydro people are doing in a very, very difficult way. Not that hydro is easy by itself.
But. Well, you don't have to select a particular viscosity, right?
Yeah.
Whereas you
do, right. So I guess in some sense this is choosing a particular relativistic fluid as given by the correspondence. So okay, now that's then the conclusions. Yeah, basically said all the stuff also mentioned. We'd also, you know, we're having a global code. There are other things that we can look at, you know, whether they have relevance to ADS CFT or not. But there are other things that, in principle, we can look at. But yeah, stop there. Thanks.